You're listening to a podcast from Blogging Heads TV.
Hi, John.
Hi, Bob.
How are you?
Fine, thank you.
Good. Let me introduce us. I'm Robert Wright. You're the famous writer, John McPhee. I should say that you are not visible to people watching the video version of this, or needless to say, to those listening to the audio podcast. But I wanted to explain why you're not visible to anyone. It may seem ironic, given that you're in the same room as I am and only several feet away from me. But before we explain that, I want to keep people on the edge of their seats and introduce you a little more fully. You are the author of many, many books, including this one, which we're going to talk about, brand new book, Draft Number 4, John McPhee on the Writing Process, which is being, I must say, very well received. Critically, doing very well, praise being lavished on it, and so on. You're the author of roughly 30 books. It depends on how you count. For example, there's a book that is actually merely an aggregation of three other books. And should we count that? I don't know. On the other hand, it did win the Pulitzer Prize for general nonfiction, so maybe we'll give you credit and say you've written at least 30 books. And I think all of them are all of them in print? Is that true?
Yes.
That's shocking. I mean, people not in the writing biz may not realize how shocking it is to have 30 books, all of which are in print. Now, you've, a lot of those books consist of stuff that was in The New Yorker, where you've been a staff writer for a while.
A while. Is 50 years a while in your book? I hope so.
It's a while.
Good.
I mean, you know, it's a while. And yet, there are other stops on your career we could talk about. You were writing cover stories for Time magazine before that, and so on. There are almost infinite depths to your biography.
So if you add it up, I'm 116 years old, in case anybody's interested.
That's an exaggeration. But it's not a huge exaggeration. No, it's a pretty big exaggeration. You are also known for your teaching at Princeton. In fact, people are getting a look at the inner sanctum here. This is your office at Princeton. And you've been teaching that course for quite a while. It's a kind of famous course on writing.
43 years, and that's accurate.
40, okay. Always make sure and tell me which of the things you say are accurate.
Okay, that one's
accurate, and we'll just assume that's the others right. Aren't.
And your name is Bob Wright,
and that's accurate.
Yeah, good.
And in fact, I was privileged to be one of your students longer ago, as they say, than either of us cares to acknowledge. You're noted for having a number of illustrious former students. Far be it from me to say whether I am in that category, but I am a former student. Let's get back to, as people presumably have inferred, this book with the subtitle On the Writing Process is on the writing process. It is, it's about writing, and I think it embodies a certain amount of what you taught in the course.
It surely does, and I therefore have a problem about my future courses, because this book contains pretty much the course I teach here. So when I give the book to the students next spring, what am I going to do? Walk out?
Will you give it to them as a textbook?
I will hand them a gift, each one, of a copy of this book in the first seminar. And what I do after that is unknown to me, because I have several months now to plan on that, and I'm going to figure it out. but
you can go fishing. They've got the book.
Yeah,
they don't need you.
The thing is, I just think go out on the lawn and walk around while they read the book or whatever.
Although we should say that a lot of the course involves things a book can't provide. For example, you have a number of one-on-one sessions with the students where you give them feedback about their writing. You also have guests who come into the seminar and so on.
Right, and that's the core of the course, is private conferences with each student about the piece of writing that they've done in that week. And so, you know, that's not in the book, and that's really where the course is at.
So let's get back to this strange fact that you're not on camera right now. This was at your request. And you know, typically people who request this are like, you know, mafia informers in the witness protection program. So I have to ask...
What do you think you know?
What?
Maybe I am a mafia informer.
I have not ruled that out. Is it related to the fact that there's no picture of you? This is where the author's picture typically goes. It's just a blank page. That's at your request also, I assume?
Oh, yes. There's never been a picture of me in any of my books.
And why is that? You're not a bad-looking guy.
No, it's not that. I just have an idea about the relationship of writers, particularly of nonfiction, to the text and to the reader. And I think that the writer should not get in between the reader and the text, and therefore carry that one extension. And I don't want my picture there, and I don't want to be on television and so on. And that's the notion. And I've been consistent with this since day one of my book publishing life. And so I didn't want to change it, even for you.
So you won't do any TV to promote this book?
No.
And that's a sacrifice. I can imagine TV shows that over the years would have been happy to have you and have asked you. What are the biggest shows that have asked you to be on?
I don't know, but my beloved publisher, the late Roger Strauss, used to jump on me for not doing that however, I resisted him. Because he wanted me to go on TV.
So you think what is the problem? If the author becomes kind of the story or something, the author is a sideshow?
Right. It mostly relates to, I mean, it's just an outgrowth of an attitude about where the writer is in a piece of nonfiction writing. Is it all about the writer? It shouldn't be. And not that just having your picture on a dust jacket is all about the writer, but it relates to this thought. I once did a 60,000 word piece for the New Yorker. It ultimately ran in three consecutive weeks. And it had the personal pronoun, I, was in it once. Because it had to be. It was about an experimental aircraft, and at the end of this long saga of this company and their aircraft, it got up into the air finally, and it was flying around above Atlantic City, and one of the engineers had a Cessna there, and he got in it to go up and fly around beside it, and I jumped in the Cessna. I could not say, you know, a visitor jumped into the Cessna, or whatever.
A reporter, as is actually sometimes done in some
New York Times used to do that. And so anyway, this one I was in the piece, and Bob Bingham, my editor, said, you can't do that. You can't have just one. You got to have more than one. So I hunted around. I found a scene in an XSO station, as it was called then, in Pennsylvania. And so I put myself in there watching this guy whack on a muffler.
That's a long way to go for an eye. So is this something that's changed over the years? I mean, as you observe the literary scene, is it more and more about the writer? I mean, I think, you know, in fact, when you were writing for Time in, what was that, the 50s and early 60s, didn't a lot of articles appear with no byline or tagline, or am I wrong about that? It seems like there used to be more of that in the Newsweeklies, in The Economist, and so on.
When I was writing at Time, all Time pieces were unsigned. Mm-hmm. They had an idea, Henry Luce's idea about group journalism, and actually a lot of reporting was done by reporters who then turned over files to writers who wrote pieces and stuff like that. There were researchers who did the same kind of thing, helping the writer, and so they were all anonymous.
And do you think this is something that's changed?
Well, the so-called new journalism came along back there too, and there was a lot of people who were very present in their pieces.
So Tom Wolfe.
Tom Wolfe, for example, and I love Tom Wolfe and love reading him, and it's just that I saw things differently in terms of what I wanted to write.
So you're not like launching a major indictment of people who say promote their books vigorously.
And furthermore, you can't say that people, writers have become ever more personally involved over time. Mm-hmm. It's not so. I mean, in the 1950s, 60s, there were plenty of writers who were right there massaging their text in front of you, like Tom Wolfe and Jimmy Breslin and so on.
When you say massaging their text, in other words, it was self-referential
just being there. I'm not saying they were monkeying around with the text. That's the wrong word to choose.
So this kind of leads to a question I have. So this book is certainly, among other things, about the technique of writing and about kinds of problems writers encounter and ways to solve them and so on. And that was to some extent what the course I took from you was about. But would you say, on balance, do you think of the course more about teaching technique or about imparting values?
Well, I suppose it's both. The values would come along in terms of what is creative nonfiction, so-called. I mean, the nut of it is you don't make it up. The creativity comes in portraying people and choosing the subject and arranging the structure of the piece and so forth, but not in inventing anything such as would be attached to the term creative writing, which is usually fiction. So, I don't know if that goes some distance toward answering your question or not.
I guess, I mean, questions like factual accuracy and the related but not entirely identical question of honesty.
Every bit of that is important. And so, I mean, so I would hope my course brought all that in terms of values and everything across. I know I mention it all the time. Depends on whether people like you are listening.
And beg your pardon?
Bob was a really good student, I wish to tell anybody.
Thanks. Listen, I got to run. That's more or less what I came for. I guess the last thing I say about values is an interesting. I think of you as kind of a traditionalist in terms of values, and yet you're not. We don't want to get into ideology, but it's not like you're a politically conservative person, and yet you are in some ways a traditionalist. Does that make sense to you? If not, we'll move on.
Well, it doesn't very much in terms of. Sure, I'm a traditionalist in terms of, I mean, if it's nonfiction writing, it ought to be pretty clear that you make nothing up, and that when people tell you that there's a blurred line between fiction and nonfiction, that's nonsense, that you can see the difference right off the bat, and that kind of thing. If that's a, conservative, archaic attitude, that's certainly mine.
And do I remember correctly that there was something about the word nonfiction that you didn't like?
Oh, I said somewhere that I wish I could quote it. It was in a magazine in an interview with Peter Hessler and
former student
and also a former student. Yeah, and I can't quote it. It was about the term not meaning much of anything. That's the thing, because it doesn't. Nonfiction says what something is. It doesn't say what it is.
Right. And when I took your course, it was called The Literature of Fact. I don't think it is anymore, but that was chosen by you?
No. Those titles of the course are functions of a university, I guess. Well, in the first place, Walt Litz, chairman of the English department and so on and so forth, gave the course that title before I ever started teaching it.
Okay.
And when I started teaching all sophomores in 2002, I had to change, I had to go away from that title because that was a 440 course and now 240, sophomore, what to call it? Well, there's a publication at the University of Pittsburgh called Creative Nonfiction. And I know the guy who created the publication and I just call my course that now.
Okay. So you're, I mean, you have something in common with the new journalism, right? The I mean, I think of the new journalism as, well, first of all, it is kind of, you are their journalism, right? It's narrative. It means to draw you right into the experience that the writer is having. Now, the new journalism does that very self-consciously and kind of self-referentially, maybe, and maybe that's a difference. But you do have, I mean, in a certain sense, the new journalism wasn't all that new.
The new journalism wasn't new at all. How about Daniel Defoe? Is that a new journalist? I mean, nonfiction writing is a, is an old thing in the history of literature in the English language. And so the idea that there was something new journalism came along, that was an idea of the people who called themselves new journalists. And I never thought of myself in any way as either part of that or anything else. You just try to do the best piece of writing you can get together about the subject you've become interested in. And it really, I don't go any deeper than that in terms of, you know, placement in categories.
Yeah, but it's I mean, it's interesting just looking at the way this book is being received so kind of warmly and by so many people. There's a sense in which you are your own category. I mean, I know you're not going to make this declaration about yourself, but the sense you get from reading a lot of people is that McPhee should almost be a literary category. Is there a humble way you can affirm that?
The thing that seems relevant to me about this general theme is that the change that has occurred. When I was an undergraduate here at Princeton in the 1950s, nobody would have thought of nonfiction writing as a thing you would teach in an English course or something like that. And I had various experiences when I was younger. I was invited to give a talk at the at the University of Utah, and I accepted, and then I got a phone call from the person who had invited me and said he was really embarrassed, but his colleagues in the English department would have nothing of some nonfiction writer coming in doing a reading, and I was disinvited. Okay, that was many years ago, and gradually this form of writing has become more acceptable to the academy, more in the teaching world, and just that is. I mean, I've noticed that as I've gone along, and I just happened into it. I mean, and I've been doing it all this time, but I certainly noticed that change. I mean, suddenly it's respectable. I hope that helps.
That does help. It reminds me of something about the texture of your writing. I mean, you pay a lot of attention to the way writing sounds. I mean, there is a... what's your relationship to poetry? You pay a lot of attention to rhythm. Isn't it true that you actually read your writing aloud as part of the writing process?
Yes, I do. I mean, it's really important to me. And when I finish this, the first draft is a kind of a mess, or it's a mess in various places. You wouldn't want to have anybody look at it or hear it. After the second draft, and by draft I mean going through the whole piece from beginning to end, which you figured out beforehand, and so therefore the first draft would be starting at the beginning and going to the end. Now start over again. You're in a computer and everything. There's not a lot of paper flying around, but that's how it goes. After the second draft, I read it aloud to one of two people. a friend here in town who is a fantastic listener, and to my wife. And he, what I'm mostly doing, I get their reactions, but mostly I'm hearing it go off my own tongue and how that works. And then I go back in the third draft and make a lot of changes accordingly. And then draft number four, which is the shortest period of time, that's why the, this is the book title. Draft number four is the last a little bit of polish that goes on at the, and it's fun. Draft number one is hideous and agonizing, and draft number four is fun. So the book is called draft number four.
Is it always four drafts exactly?
Yes.
That's amazing.
Yes, and the ratio is interesting. I mean, it's 4-1 in the following way. The first draft takes 4 times as long as the other 3 put together. Assembly California took 2 years to write. It took 6 months to do the second draft. It took 3 months for the third draft and 1 month for the fourth.
And that stays roughly constant?
It stays constant even with a little, I mean, it's amazing, but a little piece that's 1,000-1,500 words long, it only takes a few days, follows the same pattern. Those ratios are very, very consistent.
I mean, a lot of writers don't even have distinct drafts. They don't think of it that way. They go in and fiddle, and then they go in and fiddle some more, and then they go in and that. But I envy you. That gives you a kind of
Some of these writers are communicating with high deities. I'm sitting here in a room with one.
Well, it's a living, John. You're referring to one of my books in
more than
with possibly less respect than I would like. So I guess that kind of brings us to structure, which is a big emphasis of yours. When I was a student in your class, you always insisted, I think, that didn't we actually have to provide an actual schematic diagram or some kind of outline conveying what the structure of each piece we turned in was supposed to be?
Absolutely. That then, now, and every other year, too.
And you have... you spend a fair amount of the book on structure, and you actually show us these, I don't want to say crazy little diagrams you draw of your own structures, but just to give you a sense for how different they can be, I mean, here's just on 2 consecutive pages, 2 diagrams, you try to start by thinking of structure, I mean, in some cases, you actually thought of the structure before you thought of the subject, right? I mean, there have been times when you thought, oh, I would like to try this kind of structure, and what story would suit that, right?
No, what you're thinking of is that when I got the idea for that became Encounters with the Archdruid, I had long before put the ABC over D, like an equation on the board, and then I tried to think up a piece that would go with that, in which ABC and D were individuals, and that the 3 on above the line would relate all of them to the person below. But that's the only time I've ever done that. You work out structure after you've got all of your material together. Field trips and reading and notes on everything that you can think of and interviews, you got it all in a great big pile, and then you figure out how to form that.
And, okay, so it's amassing raw material, trying to discern structure, and then there's this kind of feedback process where you try to implement, I mean, you conceive of a structure, right, and then you try to implement it with the writing, and then you get frustrated.
The notes provide the structure. You read your notes over and over and over again, and then you see how they things fall into thematic and chronological categories and everything, and you're sorting out your notes accordingly, and then you want to put them all together in a sequence that makes sense in telling this story. And that's the process right there.
So certain elements naturally aggregate together by virtue of some property they have in common.
Yeah, right. For example, you're writing about an art historian. The art historian knows all kinds of things about forgery of art. He started learning about it when he was 17. He got stung by some dealer in Vienna when he was a grad student. He became the director of the Metropolitan Museum, and he certainly ought to know something about forgery there, and so on. Where do you put these things? In a chronological structure of the person's life, they keep popping up. Or do you separate them out and tell them all in one place? And if so, how do you relate that to the other similar thematic concentrations? That's what structure is all about, I think. It's just figuring out how to tell the story in a way that makes it very clear, but also moves it along logically from one thing to the next.
So it's interesting that it starts at the I guess you might say the micro level, the see kind of which things naturally, facts and so on, naturally stick together. There's no one rule for which property is sticking them together, whether it's that they were occurred at the same time or refer to the same color or whatever. But if they stick together in a certain way, you start thinking that might make a coherent stretch of narrative, a good stretch of narrative.
Right. And some of this, if you're telling a story of a journey, for example, and you're going down the Colorado River, you can use flashbacks and move things around that way. You can be at one point in the river and then remember what it was like the day before, and you can flash back there for a while. That's a perfectly legitimate thing to do. But the chronology of the river trip can't be altered. It can't. I mean, you're not. It controls itself. But you can place the facts of about a person's life, for example, who's involved in this trip, anywhere you want them, because you're just. Mm-hmm. It's a parenthetical. Okay. So the relationship of those parentheticals to the narrative structure, narrative progression is. You got some interesting choices to make. This is the aspect of writing that excites me most when I'm doing it.
Okay, so ultimately, I mean, even once you have a satisfactory bunch of clusters, you have to arrange, figure out the relationship among them, and then that's the higher level structural question, and then you're kind of done if it turns out you're right.
Well, there's a huge difference, in, as I see it, but you know, between. The general process of writing fiction and nonfiction. In nonfiction, you collect your material and you have it at the start. A fiction writer, I think largely, I mean, I know that they plan things, but largely I think they're feeling their way. I think it's a harder form of writing to do. I have two daughters who do it, and I'm pretty sure that that's the case. And factual writer, the nonfiction writer, has got his pile of material on the table. It's like bringing home groceries and you put them on the kitchen counter. You're going to make dinner of it. And as I said in the book, if something's red and globular there, you don't call it a tomato if it's a bell pepper, mm-hmm. because you're writing nonfiction. But you have all that material there to make that dinner with or whatever, and it's the same. I mean, the analogy holds for the material that a nonfiction writer collects. Mm-hmm. But I have the one thing is that I think if you write your lead, because you could start almost anywhere. There's nothing dictates where you need to start. And if you get your lead written just out of the blue, just sit down and write it, then it'll, and you get to a satisfactory lead. You like it. Then you go back and look at this massive material and it'll all fall into pieces much, much more easily. It's much easier to develop a structure if you've got a lead you like and that's where you want to start.
And a lead for you can be how long?
2,000 words or 2 sentences.
Uh-huh. And is that in proportion to the size of the overall piece of writing?
Yes. Yes, it generally is. I mean, I had a lead literally in Assembling, California. It was about 2,000 words. It was about the place where the San Andreas Fault intersects the sea below San Francisco. And I wrote this 2,000 words about Muscle Rock, as it's called, and I sent it off to Sarah Lippincott, who was had been my editor at the New Yorker and was now freelancing in California, and I sent that to her, and we talked back and forth until I was really sure that those 2,000 words was where this book should start. That's the one I referred to that took 2 years to write the first draft. And when I went on to structure that book, it was so much easier after that lead had settled in. That's probably the longest lead I ever wrote before turning to do the structure.
And by the end of a lead, what has been accomplished?
You got your foot on the beach. You have written something. You are now committed. People often ask me if I've ever given up a project. It's easy to give them up before you've written anything, but if you've written one sentence that you like, you're hooked. And that's what I do. Once I've gotten started with a sentence or two sentences or three sentences, then there's no going back.
Now there's a kind of structural paradigm that I think you're not a big fan of in a certain sense. And it's actually one I kind of tend to naturally adhere to. I'm referring to the so-called nut graph or billboard paragraph of I think that term is particularly common at like news weeklies. And the way I often think of a piece is like the lead gets you to a paragraph that in some sense, with varying degrees of explicitness, summarize or foreshadow what lies ahead or what the whole piece is about. And there's kind of a distinct jumping off point. And you can see this in a whole lot of like Newsweekly pieces, like, okay, that's the nut graph. It, you know, if it's like a 5,000 word piece, it may have taken, 400 words to get there, but whatever, you can just feel it. You can see it. That's not exactly what you have in mind as the end of one of your leads, right?
Sometimes I'm appalled by a term like nut graph and so forth. But basically because, and to the extent, and it's a large extent, that it's formulaic, that people think that it's the basic, it's an essential thing. This is the way it's done. That is totally formulaic. You can write your piece, you can experiment with all kinds of things, and you don't need a nut graph unless you want a nut graph or whatever those things are called. It's the formulaic aspect of it that I react to. Heaven knows I've written plenty of pieces that way. The old standard thing for a Time cover story, for example, was some kind of jazzy lead, and then what Brad Dara used to call the billboard, or more recently this term nut graph came along, which sort of says why you're writing the piece. And then you go on until you're about two-fifths of the way through this thing about Joe Doakes, and then you stop and you say, Joe Doakes was born in Elgin, Illinois in 1938. And then you go on up through the person's life, and then you wind up with some more biographical jazz at the end, and you've got your cover story. Well, there's nothing wrong with that structure. It's just that it's not the cookie cutter for all writing.
Okay. Now, this brings us to writer's block in a way. I think one thing you say in the book is that if you're wrestling with structure and you feel stymied, that's a good time to stop and try to write the lead.
I would say you write your lead whether you're stymied or not. Get your lead written and then you can.
But you always start with the
yes.
You do.
Yes.
So you've got your raw material. You've
got the raw material and don't even refer to it. You've been out in the field for 3 months with somebody and you know it. So you know where you want to start this thing or you try to figure it out. What I'm saying is that you don't need to keep reading your notes over and over again at this point. You write a lead right out of the blue somewhere and keep at it all week long or whatever until you got something you like, then go back and look at those notes and make a structure, and it's much more efficient, much easier.
Okay. Now, there's a place in the book where you give advice to a former student. I'm sorry to say it's not me. Someone named Joel. You don't provide his last name. I think I have a suspicion.
He's a friend of both of us.
Well, speak for yourself, John. I think coincidentally, though, there is a blurb on the back of this book from a Joel Achenbach.
His name is Joel Achenbach, and he's a great writer.
Okay. No, I'm a big fan of Joel's. But I want you to read I think this is something you actually sent him. A letter you actually sent him.
Yes,
absolutely. And I think you'll know when to stop at the end here. But he wrote you about his writer's block, and this starts with "Dear Joel," right there. The letter you wrote him. What, this is several decades ago?
Yes, way back when he was a young writer. What do you want me to read?
Just starting with "Dear Joel" there, and continuing
there. Fine. He wrote to me, as other former students have been known to do, and he's all stymied. He can't get anywhere. He's trying to do a piece of writing, and it's horrible. It's not going well. Blah blah blah. So he writes a note to me, and he tells me that, and I sat down once and ripped off this note to him. "Dear Joel," the reason I'm pausing is that I stopped here to... In the book, this thing has inserted stuff where I'm commenting to the reader. So, "Dear Joel, ... this Joel will win huge awards and write countless books in a nationally syndicated column. But at the time of this letter, he has just been finding out that to cross the electric fence from the actual world to the writing world requires at least as much invention as the writing itself. Dear Joel, you are writing, say, about a grizzly bear. No words are forthcoming. For 6, 7, 10 hours, no words have been forthcoming. You are blocked, frustrated, in despair. You are nowhere, and that's where you've been getting. What do? You write, 'Dear Mother,' and then you tell your mother about the block, the frustration, the ineptitude, the despair. You insist that you are not cut out to do this kind of work. You whine, you whimper, you outline your problem, and you mention that the bear has a 55-inch waist and a neck more than 30 inches around, but could run nose to nose with Secretariat. You say the bear prefers to lie down and rest. The bear rests 14 hours a day. And you go on like that as long as you can, and then you go back and delete the 'Dear Mother' and all the whimpering and whining and just keep the bear."
That's a good idea. I mean, it's related to the fact that sometimes just discussing your problem with somebody can be helpful. And they'll tell you, you know, where the story is sometimes. But in listening to you, I was reminded that I think you often do your own audiobook readings, right?
Yes.
Well, always, or
for the there was a time when they said no authors. We, you know, the policy was not to have authors reading. And then I heard an author reading one time, and I went back to Farrar Straus, and I said, "This is, get me the job. I want to do it." And so I've recorded things since the Founding Fish, which is around essentially this century,
including this book.
But not, I recorded this
you
book.
Did the article.
It's done now. Yeah, yeah. It's
well, good. You're good. So that version of the author appearing in a certain sense as part of the work is fine. That's not a distraction in the way that the picture of the author would be.
For me, it's just totally essential. The oral tradition in writing is just a huge, deep thing. And I mean, I wouldn't be a writer if I'm always mumbling words to myself. I remember my father doing that. He'd sit in the car, he's driving along, and I'd hear him saying things. He just liked letting words run off his tongue. And this is such an important component of a piece of writing to me that no, I don't have any problem about it at all.
And so have you had the experience of hearing your, you had narrators who weren't you originally,
That's right.
And was that an uncomfortable experience?
Well, with all respect, I mean, one of them was a college classmate of mine and so on and so forth. And this is just me. I mean, I can't listen to it because I hear the sentences in my own way.
It is always a little strange to hear
somebody
else doing it. So you have a chapter called Editors and Publisher. And you talk a lot about William Shawn, the legendary editor of the New Yorker for so many years. I'm curious about kinds of different productive relationships with editors there can be. I mean, he comes off as somebody who maintained a certain kind of distance from writers, whereas I think there are other editors you've had in a, you know, more personal or intimate, in some sense, relationships, psychologically intimate relationships with. Is that fair to say?
Yeah, I mean, right. Relationships with every editor I've ever had have been unique because they're unique. And I was extremely lucky to happen, as a function of age and so on and so forth, to happen into the New Yorker magazine when William Shawn was in his heyday, and his preoccupation as an editor was the long fact piece. And that's what I was writing, the long fact piece. So it was just an era when things worked out and I got to develop my form of writing with a lot of space around it.
Yeah, I mean, I hope you appreciate that you've had kind of a dream career in that sense, right? Because you've been, I mean, I know he had to approve assignments, editors have to approve assignments, but to a large extent, you've been allowed to pursue your interest to write what you wanted to write about.
All the way, how you wanted to write. To a complete extent.
Yeah.
With
them.
He never
said no?
He said no. But you know, when ideas for nonfiction writing are a dime a dozen. They just flow by like neutrons and it's easy to give up one thing and get to another. And when he said no, or he said, oh no, that's reserved in a general way for another writer. He never mentioned other people to other writers. And that wasn't hard to take because he just moved on to something else. But I wasn't assigned anything. I came along with these ideas and you'd say to him, Oranges. Oh yes, that'd be good. I mean, what's he thinking about?
Yeah, you wrote a whole book called Oranges. This is sometimes cited by way of conveying your ability to make any subject interesting, because one wouldn't imagine reading a whole book about oranges. I remember I was a long time ago in my 20s, I was at the Washington Post. It wasn't quite a job interview, but it was kind of a vocational counseling interview with David Marinus, and you had actually played a role in setting it up, I think. And Marinus, I think the idea was he would be helpful in maybe getting me a job at one of the Washington Post kind of farm clubs, so to speak, newspapers that they sometimes help place people at. And he said he was such a big fan of yours, and he said, what was your big takeaway from McPhee and his class? And I had this uncomfortable feeling like there was a right answer to this question and I wanted to get it right. And I didn't, but his take home was McPhee shows that you can take any subject and make it interesting. Do you actually think that's true? That you can that one could write about anything and make it interesting?
Well, you see, it doesn't work that way with me because I get into the subject because I'm interested in it. I'm a priori interested in it. Therefore, I don't feel the need to make it interesting. I write about real people in real places and what they do, and that's interesting infinitely. And that's what all these things are about, oranges, bears, whatever. I mean, it's about the people who deal with them, where they came from, what makes them interested in their work, and so on and so forth. And that is the consistent common denominator of everything in all of this miscellaneous writing that I've done. And it's fundamentally interesting. So if they're orange growers, if they're Ben Hill Griffin, the big cheese in concentrated orange juice and so forth in Florida, they're all interesting people.
Does this mean that you don't worry very much about what is of interest to your readers? I mean, are you just kind of following your enthusiasms and you figure, well, those people who agree with me about what merits enthusiasm will like this and the rest won't?
Well, the basic thing is that if you're not really interested, if you're caught up in what you're trying to do, the worst thing in the world you can do is to market research your writing that you say, well, people would like this because it would be popular, and then you go do it. You're likely to just founder in the writing of it, because writing is so difficult. What carries you through is that you're really interested yourself, and as opposed to market researching what you do. I believe that deeply.
Now, there's a place in your book where you say that, given your choice, I think you say this, you would rather kind of overhear a conversation that's just happening, observe it, then interview someone. Is that?
Yes. Well, I'm very nervous and shy about interviews and sitting across a desk with somebody in an office. And I think that's hard work. I mean, it certainly is for me, as opposed to, and what I have going for me in these things is time. I get together with somebody, and then I get to know him a little bit, and then I'm in his pickup riding around Wyoming or something like that, and he's teaching me the geology of Wyoming, and we spend a lot of time together, and then gradually I just sort of fade into the pickup, and I feel at home there, and I'm scribbling notes the whole time and bouncing around, and that's how it goes, and as opposed to the formality of a formal interview would for me be less productive that way. Mm-hmm. That's why I envy envy is the wrong word. Why I admire daily journalists so much for their ability to go out and get a story and write it the same day and publish it. I'm awestruck.
I guess this is an unanswerable question. I was going to ask, to what extent are you driven by interest in the subject, and to what extent by interest in the people who are the vehicles for learning about it and talking about it?
It starts with the subject. I mean, for example, the long thing I did, I was going to do a talk piece on Talk of the Town piece in the New Yorker about a rock outcrop outside New York. I just had this idea, and I asked a geologist here in Princeton to do it with me, to talk about the provenance of the Manhattan Schist or whatever it would be, and this thing developed. And 20 years later, I finished this project, and it amounted to four and a half books or something, and it started with an interest in rock, and gradually, though, if you were going across the Appalachians, for example, who's an Appalachian geologist, really interesting, Anita Harris of the U.S. Geological Survey, a Conodont paleontologist, and I traveled with her from New Jersey to Chicago, and this is about Anita, but it's also about the rock, but it started with the subject and it moved on to the people who are involved with the subject. That was true with one geologist after another in that project.
So the geology, it consumed three books, which were then aggregated into the book that won the Pulitzer Prize for four books. So wait, Basin and Range, In Suspect Terrain.
Basin and Range, In Suspect Terrain, Rising from the Plains, okay. And Assembling California. And then I had left, I had out of that, what I'm doing is writing about North American geology, but not in a kind of linear way. And the left out of those four was the Midwest. I mean, from Chicago to the Rockies. And this needed addressing. So I went to the University of Kansas and got into the Midwest doesn't have a hell of a lot of rock sticking out. See? And so what's really interesting is the basement, the deep stuff under eastern Colorado and Nebraska and so on. And so I went there to a geochronologist, Randy Van Schmoos, a guy who specializes in the chronology of extremely old rock, and it's way down under the Craton, which is the middle of the continent. And so I wrote that, and it's not really book length. It's about 50% of a book length. There's at any rate, that's in Annals of the Former World. That's book five of Annals of the Former World, because
is the title that the four collected had, Annals of the Former World.
Yeah, and that was the overall title, and I added Crossing the Craton,
Okay.
Because there was that big hunk of the country left out.
Okay. Now, as you've said, I mean, there's two kinds of people in responding to your geology stuff. There's the kind who love it, and there's the kind who say, John, oranges was one thing, but rocks. Does it say something? I mean, you're clearly fascinated by geology, and I suspect that interest predated this work. I don't know, but does your interest in geology say anything about you or the nature of your interests more generically or anything?
We live on this planet. It's the only one we've got, and it's really interesting. It's history across time and so forth. And I took a high school course in geology that was basically geomorphology, and that in college I did physics and biology and everything somewhere else, and courses for people like me, and So it was a long-standing interest in geology that caused me to get that interest in doing that little talk piece that turned into the 20 years of work. But about the reaction to it, it's very interesting, I think. First of all, William Shawn, editor of the New Yorker, when I told him I'd like to do this, he said, "All right. Very well," he said, "readers will rebel." So indeed, readers did rebel. There was a lawyer in Boston who wrote me a letter, and he had big block letters. He had his corporate stationery, but under that, in big block letters, he wrote, "Please stop writing about geology." And I refrained from writing a letter saying, what we could use in this country is one less lawyer. But then on his side of the ledger, there were any number of people, right? Readers did rebel. But I can't tell you how many times I've gotten, Annals of the Former World is 750 pages long, and it's pretty dense somewhere. And people write to me and say they're into it for the second time, the third time. It really illustrates the two cultures that C.P. Snow talked about. There's people who are hugely interested in the geology I've written, about the things I've written about geology, as well as those who rebel against it. And in nothing else I've ever gotten into is there such a polarity.
Mm-hmm. So you've written about so much aside from rocks. I mean, as he said, oranges, but also, you know, nuclear physics and the issue of nuclear weapons, sports, both, you know, tennis and levels of the game. Your kind of breakthrough piece for the New Yorker was a profile of Bill Bradley. Is there any subject you would not be interested in if you started looking into it? If you started looking into it as something you might write about, can you think of whole categories that you just?
There must be lots of them. I mean, Sean, the one piece that William Sean ever suggested that I write, he could call me into his office and he wanted me to write about hospitals in New York City. And this was long ago, 25, 30 years ago, and it had to do with what has evolved as the great debates about healthcare. I tiptoed out of his office. I didn't want to do that.
I think you would have found something to get fascinated by if you had looked into it personally.
Band-Aids.
That's a good example. You could write a book about Band-Aids. Is that the next on your list, Band-Aids?
That's it. Digital Band-Aids.
I would read that book. So just want to close by talking a little bit about things you like and don't like in writing. You don't like what's called borrowed vividness, or at least you don't like certain forms of borrowed vividness.
Well, I mean, if you say that, if you're the writer and you say that this person looks like Tom Cruise and you let it go at that, you're having Tom Cruise do your writing for you. And that's borrowed vividness. Borrowed vividness is, and you can do it. I mean, I have a passage in this book about borrowed vividness as borrowed by Robert Wright, in case you know who that is. And Bob Wright paid back the borrowed vividness by going on with a really rich description of the, it turned out to be the Quaker Oats Quaker kind of thing Bob writes about. And
I gotta say, that was one of my finest literary moments.
It was really good. But the borrowed vividness, he said of Kenneth Boulding.
Kenneth Boulding.
And he said he looks like the Quaker Oats Quaker. See, now if Bob had stopped there, Bob deserved, imprisonment. But he went on and he described the Quaker Oats Quaker and the analogy to Boulding in much detail. That was really good.
And Boulding was in fact a Quaker. So there, that was so. I wasn't gonna mention that myself.
That's why you brought it up.
It was a little bit of a prompting, I have to admit. So other now, you know, I think I'm kind of surprised by cases where you're willing to make life a little hard on the reader in a certain sense. I mean, you're always willing to use words that many people don't know the meaning of. I mean, maybe with, in some cases like geology, that's hard to avoid, but you also play with it, right? I mean, there are times when you have these kind of poetic passages that include words that people may well not know, which is fine. People have dictionaries, and these days they have them, online and with them at all times. But that's one example. Does that seem to ring true to you that you're perfectly willing to employ words that people won't immediately?
If I have a purpose, and the purpose is not just to employ a word that people won't understand. There has to be something more to it. Humor, there's all kinds of things. If I had an example, or I could give you examples, there's much more to it when you. I spend a lot of time reading dictionaries, and I'm looking for words, and I'm not looking for words that people don't know. I'm looking for the best simple word that covers what I want to cover. Usually, I mean, the whole search is for greater simplicity rather than a Nabokovian polysyllabic passage.
Yeah.
That sounded really convinced.
No, I'm convinced. It just reminds me that when I took your class, you brought to our attention that we could get the compact edition of the Oxford English Dictionary, which I see over there on the other side of your office, if we subscribe to the Book of the Month Club for a pretty limited amount of time, and it wouldn't be a bad investment. And I still have my copy. It's so compact that it comes with a magnifying glass because it's what was originally God knows how many volumes packed
11.
Into two. 11. Packed into two. And you know, there's just a pleasure that can be had by a certain kind of person, including me and probably you, just by poring over that thing. I mean, if you're thinking about using a word and you have the time, which sadly I often don't, but if you're thinking about using a word in a piece of writing, it seems to me there is no greater pleasure than just getting out the OED and just looking at the evolution of the word, because that's what the OED shows you. Like from the earliest thing we know about the use of this word to, you know, the more recent, this is how the word evolved. And it gives you the fullest sense you can get of the historical resonances of the word. But is that a, is this a secret?
Absolutely.
Pleasure?
That's the beauty of the OED. I think that Nabokov memorized it. I mean, he is the most amazing.
What about his writing makes you?
Oh well, I mean, I think it might places where three words exist where one would do a better job than the three, uh-huh. and stuff like that. But those are minor things. I mean, at any rate, he had a fantastic vocabulary, to put it mildly.
Okay. Then just one more example of your willingness to occasionally complicate the life of your reader. You tell it the story in the book where you were referring to the socioeconomic class of some people who attended the Wimbledon tennis tournament, and you said starboard in, starboard out.
Starboard out, starboard,
starboard
home.
Starboard out, starboard home, I'm sorry. And your editor is like, what the hell is this? And you explain to him that, well, one of the posited etymologies of the term posh is that it meant port out, starboard home. So for people who already know that, they may understand that what I'm saying about these people, anyway, we won't get into the whole thing, but I mean, come on, John. How many readers do you think knew what you meant?
Well, what he said, the editor said, was one person in 10,000 will get that. What I was saying was that the etymology of posh is poured out, starboard home, because you're in an unair-conditioned ship going out to India or something, and you want to be on the shaded side both ways. See, because you had the most money, you could afford the staterooms on that side. Posh, poured out, starboard home. And I was saying to these people that they weren't quite on the Ascot level of English society. They were a little bit below it. Starboard out, sunny side, you know, cheaper. Yeah. And then they make their money and everything, they come back starboard home. Okay, and the editor says, not one person in 10,000 will get that. And I said to him, you have bought 11,000 words without any question about like this. Keep that line for that one reader. And he said, sold. The context here was that I was writing about frame of reference, the things that a writer refers to in order to, we do it all the time. I mean, the frame of reference of the writer just rolls through the whole piece. If you allude to New York, your reader knows what it is. If you say, the name of some obscure town somewhere, he's not going to know what it is. This is frame of reference, and you make these choices all the way as you write. There is an inverse thing with frame of reference where, for humor's sake, you use something that will be completely obscure like that, but not to somebody who gets it. And that's fun. That's all. Writing has to be fun once in a while, once in a million years. As you don't know, because you always sweat and suffer through all the things you write, whereas, of course,
you don't. There are no stories in this book about you lying on a table for days or whatever, paralyzed by doubt and...
I was pretending I was Bob Wright.
Well, that was a good imitation. So, okay, then your playfulness, I guess, is what accounts for your using phrases like a sincere mustache. I'm just reading, this is from your mustache oeuvre.
Yeah, no.
You've called mustaches sincere, no nonsense. These are in different pieces. An analgesic mustache, a soothing mustache, a tetragrammatonic mustache. Well, I know what that is. A gyroscopic mustache. I mean, would you like to apologize? I'm going to give you an opportunity to apologize to readers.
Never.
For inflicting these things.
Never. That started with an editor of mine who had a mustache, and I was kidding around with him, and I got into being the mustache person at the New Yorker, and all those things like the analgesic mustache was a doctor in Maine and so forth who had this, and that's actually in the text of this book where I said writing has to be fun once in a while, and so I don't apologize one bit for the...
What does a sincere mustache look like?
If I told you, if you have to ask that question, you would not understand.
I'm not worthy of reading your work.
No, if you have to ask that question, you just wouldn't understand.
I feel...
I
am suffused in shame. Okay, well, thank you, John. I feel very lucky to have taken your course. I feel lucky that we found ourselves in close enough geographic proximity to get to know each other a lot better. And I feel lucky that we're about to go out to lunch, and presumably you'll have the...
Thank you. It was a lot of fun, Bob.
To pay for it.
Okay.
Thank you.
I can finish with a laugh right there. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to Blogging Heads TV. You can help support this content by remembering to like us on Facebook and follow us on Twitter. You can subscribe to all Blogging Heads episodes or to a specific program by going to our subscribe page at bloggingheads.tv/subscribe. There you can sign up for podcast downloads via iTunes or Stitcher, or you can subscribe to our email and we'll send you an alert every time we post a new episode.